Welcome to Writers on Writing. I'm your host, Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and I'm here every Wednesday evening from 6:30 to 7, talking to authors, editors, agents, those connected with the art or the business of writing. You might want to keep a pencil and paper handy to jot down words of wisdom you hear from my featured guest or information about books by the beach that I'll talk about later. Tonight, my guest is Carolyn Wheat. Carolyn is an award-winning mystery author who until 4 years ago was a defense attorney in Brooklyn, New York. In 1994, she discovered she had breast cancer and decided that it was time to make her writing a priority. She took off in a westerly direction, and after being a writer in residence for the University of Central Oklahoma, ended up in 1997 in Oceanside. Quite a trip. In January of 1998, she was named one of San Diego Magazine's 50 People to Watch in 1998. From her home office, she also acts as a writing coach and teaches classes and seminars. She's had a number of short stories published and 6 novels. Her latest is Sworn to Defend, which Publishers Weekly heralds as a complex page-turner and a fast-paced novel. I can attest to that. Welcome, Carolyn.
Well, thanks, Barbara. It's nice to be here.
Great to have you. Would you describe your book for our listeners and anything you want to say about the theme of your work?
Well, Cassandra Jameson, whose name turns out to have more meaning than it did when I chose it. When I chose her name Cassandra, I, of course, knew who Cassandra was from the Greek myths. But as the 6 books have gone on, I find her becoming more and more like Cassandra in that she often knows before other people do that something is wrong. She doesn't always know what it is or how to fix it, mm-hmm. but she has that sense of impending doom or that things are going to turn out badly, but she can't stop things from going badly. Mm-hmm. And that's essentially what happens in this book as well. She's a good defense attorney, meaning that she knows that many of her clients are guilty.
Mm-hmm.
She's used to that, and she knows how to handle guilty clients. What she's forgotten how to do is handle an innocent client. Take care of somebody who she really, really believes is innocent of the crime.
Mm-hmm.
She has an appeal for this guy. She argues the appeal. She's successful. The skies look blue, except that she finds out that he's guilty of something worse than mm-hmm. what he was convicted
right.
of. That he has, in fact, been a stalker, and she has gotten him released, and now maybe he's fixated on her.
The book is so densely plotted. It's very impressive. Just when you think you know who the truly the bad guy is, it changes. Kirk has called you a natural storyteller. Is it natural? Did you have to work at it? Or
oh, I work like a dog.
Has this always
box.
Been the case?
I will certainly say I'm a natural storyteller in that I was the kid in the neighborhood who would sit all the other kids down and tell stories in the garage. My sister vividly recalls The Green Claw, which was a horror story that came to me as I looked at a green garden tool hanging uh-huh. on the wall of the garage. But The Green Claw was a neighborhood like Stephen King. In
yeah.
the Stephen King movies always has people telling stories. But to make plots actually work takes a huge amount of work. It's,
mm-hmm.
It doesn't – I think I overdo it because it's not the natural thing for
mm-hmm.
me. I have to work very hard at it, and sometimes I think maybe I – go one step too far into it. I don't know.
It doesn't seem so.
Well, good. Thank you.
So when you used to tell these stories as a child, they were mysteries?
I was a mystery person for, mm-hmm. from very early days.
Nancy Drew?
No, actually not. I must Judy Bolton. A little Judy Bolton I'll concede to. But no, when I started reading adult books, I went to Perry Mason. So I really do believe I was born into both of my professions,
mm-hmm.
as a defense attorney and as a writer.
Mm-hmm.
And so fortunately the two have come together here.
But you started out as an attorney.
Yes. I always wanted to write mysteries. In fact, uh-huh. when I was in law school, I started writing a mystery in my copious spare time, which was it's dreadful. I actually took it out of mothballs to look at it, and
mm-hmm.
it is utterly dreadful. But it was the impulse to write a mystery was there even then.
Mm-hmm.
It was part of something I wanted to do, but I didn't know anybody who had ever done it, you know? So
mm-hmm.
the going from there are these books out there written by people that I don't know and will never know
right.
versus I can do this, that's a leap.
Mm-hmm.
You have to work at that a bit.
Mm-hmm. Would you read a bit?
Okay.
From Sworn to Defend.
This is chapter 1. Innocence is a bitch. Innocent clients haunt you till the day you die. No matter that you've done your best. Your guy's serving time for something he didn't do, and it's all your fault. If you were half the lawyer you think you are, you'd have convinced the jury to let him go. Fortunately, I hadn't had all that many innocent clients in the course of my practice. Keith Jernigan was one of them. I was on my way to the appellate division to argue for his freedom, scuffing my feet in golden brown sycamore leaves and gazing at the pure blue sky through feathery Japanese maple leaves against neat brick townhouses. It was a perfect fall day, crisp and bright as a fresh-picked apple, but I didn't care about the play of sunlight on the brownstones or the bronze chrysanthemums in ornate planters next to intricate wrought iron gates. All I cared about was whether I could convince a majority of the appellate division that a gross miscarriage of justice had taken place. Because if I couldn't, a guy who called me the Trojan Princess, who sent me letters with my first name spelled out in Greek, who sent me cards at Christmas and on my birthday, who had the sharpest wit and the sweetest smile I'd ever seen, a guy who had absolutely, completely, totally not committed the crime for which he was serving time, that guy was going to rot in jail for 7 more years, and I'd lose whatever tiny shred of faith I had left in the criminal justice system. But that thought didn't bear thinking. I couldn't lose this case. I just couldn't.
Thank you. If you've just tuned in, you have just heard Carolyn Wheat read from her new book, Sworn to Defend. How much of your own personal life is in your work?
Well, Cass is more me than I ever intended her to be. But for one thing, it's just easier.
Mm-hmm.
She's a photography, an amateur photographer, mm-hmm. and I certainly have been. I don't do it much anymore, but I drew on some of my own experiences, whereas if I had said, well, let her play the guitar, mm-hmm. I would have had to learn a whole lot about playing the guitar. So when in doubt, I tend to reach into my own bag of tricks, so mm-hmm. to speak. On the other hand, I've moved to California, and she's still in Brooklyn.
Mm-hmm.
She has the law office right. I can picture that building. It's on Court Street in Amity. There mm-hmm. happens to be a Japanese restaurant, really, in the ground floor. But, I mean, I have got this whole vision of where she lives and the path that mm-hmm. she has taken. It's like the path not taken in my own life, where I have left the law, I have left the East, and she's still living that mm-hmm. life. So she is, in a sense, me if I had stayed on that path. And, of course, she's thinner and more beautiful than I am. But that's one of the prerogatives of writing as well.
You can do that.
Is that we get to, she can eat all she wants and never gains a pound.
Well, there. Speaking of Brooklyn, you have wonderful descriptions about Brooklyn. When I lived on the East Coast, I went there time and again to visit friends and such, and it's Brooklyn in your book.
It's funny how having left made me even more aware of mm-hmm. certain aspects of it, and of course I did go back. And I went into Crown Heights, which figures in this book, Crown Heights being a Hasidic neighborhood
mm-hmm.
where it's very Jewish. You turn on Kingston Street, and it's like you're in downtown Tel Aviv. There are mm-hmm. signs all over in Hebrew. You're not in America anymore in some ways, and yet these people are certainly American citizens. They're just living a very religious, very insular life there.
Mm-hmm.
That was fascinating. So, yes, I do a little extra research because that wasn't part of my normal life in Brooklyn, mm-hmm. was to go over there, but I knew it was there, and I was fascinated by it. By people who have made such a commitment to their faith that they've essentially closed their doors on the 20th century, except for one thing.
What's
they've
that?
Got a heck of a website. You want to find out about the Lubavitcher Hasidic community, you go on the internet and you get... It is, because mm-hmm. they dress like Amish people in a way. They dress mm-hmm. very plain, very... I mean, there are certain... And yet, unlike the Amish, they have no problem with technology, except on the Sabbath.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Speaking of research, what sort of research did you do for this book?
Well, let's see. I did research in Hasidic Judaism, Japanese antiques, and stalking. Because fortunately, I have never, in fact, been stalked. Although, certainly, I was damn lucky, I have to say, looking back at my life. Mm-hmm. Because I always had my address and phone number listed in the phone book mm-hmm. when I was representing criminal
attorney.
Clients. I mean... Looking back, and I think living in the world we live in today, mm-hmm. I think I would have been much more prudent. I think that it has become a scarier world, and or we're just knowing more about how scary it is. I'm not quite sure which it is, but I do know that I think I was lucky Because anybody can become the subject of a stalker. We tend to think of it as ex-husbands or ex-wives, although men tend to be more inclined toward it than females. We certainly have had fatal attraction situations, though, too, where women have been the stalkers. But at any rate, it doesn't just happen in personal relationships. It can happen to anybody with any level of celebrity.
Mm-hmm.
And anybody who has a relationship with somebody, whether it's at work or through a job like being an attorney or a local news person. In fact, I got something off the internet, a long thing from AFTRA, I think it was, talking about how people in local news had to be very careful of stalkers. It's just out there. So I did do some research into this, too, and looking at the internet and this a book that I mentioned before, we were talking privately, Gavin De Becker's The Gift of Fear.
Mm-hmm.
Because while there's been a lot written about this, what De Becker has done is really break it down into very predictable behavior, what he calls essentially predictors, where you can have a conversation with somebody and just a couple of things will hit you wrong. And he says, first of all, listen to those things.
Mm-hmm.
Listen to your fear inside. Don't talk yourself out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And if you analyze these precursors, behaviors, you will see that it's never, he just snapped.
Mm-hmm.
It is never, he was such a nice boy, we never saw this coming. You
always
look into the past, there's always foreshadowing. There's always something that people talk themselves out of believing.
Mm-hmm.
Because we'd all like to live in a civilized society. We'd all like to believe that we're all socialized enough that these things can't happen. But we don't. Mm-hmm. And
if you've just tuned in, you're listening to KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, Writers on Writing, and I'm talking with Carolyn Wheat, and we're discussing her new book, Sworn to Defend. How did your character Cass Jamison come about? Did she just come? I mean, you talked a little about her name earlier, but was this a character that just sort of took birth in your head, or did you design? You know, was there a special planning that went on to say, well, I want her to be this, and I want her to be this, and she's going to look like this, and she's going to like this. And
well, some of both.
Mm-hmm.
This was a long time ago, actually. My first book came out in 1983, so.
And you're not tired of her yet?
Well, I had a long hiatus where I kept going back to work. And no, I'm not. It's just that I do, like any writer, have a desire to do something else once in a while. You know, I really would not want to just write one series with one character and no other. I do know that some prominent people making a good living are doing this.
Mm-hmm.
But I like the challenge of writing something different, which is why my short stories have involved Marilyn Monroe and Route 66 and Sherlock Holmes. And they've often been very different from what I do in the novels, because I like the chance to do something completely different. Well, Cass really is something of an alter ego. She really is, in a sense. I mean, she, you know, a lot of people were doing that in those days, you understand. A lot of the women sleuths that were created in this period, and bear in mind that when I started writing, Grafton and Paretsky had not yet published. Their books came out in 1982. So I had already begun this thinking about this female lawyer character. And the book I mentioned earlier that I was trying to write when I was in law school, oddly enough, I was one of three women in my graduating class of 1971 from the University of Toledo Law School. This prospective mystery that I was writing had two male characters as the detectives, and there was a female law student in it, but she was very much a secondary character.
Mm-hmm.
The idea that you could sit down and write with a female protagonist was, oddly enough, not something that really... I mean, here I was pioneering enough to go to law school with 80 guys and two other women, and yet when it came to writing, my own life was a footnote in that idea. So finally, by the time I started writing, the idea that you would write about a female like yourself seemed like a reasonable thing to do, which was good. And so, yeah, she just became something of me and yet different, because I don't solve mysteries very much.
You have quite a facility for dialogue. Is this something that you work hard at, or is it just
no, actually,
you listen?
Honestly, I hear the voices in my head, which I know can be a little scary sometimes, but it's true. I sit at the computer now, thank God. I wrote 3 books in longhand, you know, and typed them. I'm the world's worst typist, and then would have to go pay somebody to type them really and stand over her with a bottle of whiteout in my hand. So thank God I now have a computer. But no, I get to writing it, and it's as if I can hear the voices telling me what, you know, to say. This doesn't happen with plotting, unfortunately. They never tell me what they're going to do, just what they're saying.
How much do you plot and outline? Is that
I am an outliner. I definitely, which is not to say that the book itself always lives up to the outline. Mm-hmm. There are times when, because I have a tendency, perhaps we all do, but I certainly do, to paper over a few things, you know, like I'll have it all in my mind. They're going to do this. So-and-so will go here and meet so. And by the time I start writing it, then I realize, wait a minute, there is no earthly reason for so-and-so to go here. And then I'll realize it doesn't entirely work. And then so often the outline has to be retinkered with in the, on the page. But I need to have that sense of where I'm going. And I usually have a good sense of who did it. But sometimes something better comes to me. Sometimes
as you're writing.
Yes, I'm writing. And I can't ignore the gut feeling that says, I like to go for what I consider the heartbreak choice. I have to say. What I'm aiming for is not only that you won't know who did it, but that when you do begin to think you know who did it, you're thinking, oh, no, not him. Please not him.
Oh, no.
But it will be. That's life. These people, it's not my fault. This is how they choose to live their lives.
Do you miss practicing law?
No. I got to say that. I can get deeply into legal discussions on television. If I had sat down with Bill Clinton, he would not be in this mess today. But it's easy to say from the sidelines. In other words, I do rather enjoy the kind of running commentary on what's out there. But no, the responsibility. If I was a criminal lawyer, of having somebody's life in your hands, I could not practice law and write at the same time. And even when I left that kind of law to go work for the city, I mean, I worked for the city. I worked for the police department. 9-to-5 job. I was writing, but it still ate up more of my life than I could really. I'm happy enough being out of it if I can continue with the writing.
How did you choose criminal law?
Well, I didn't. I chose poverty law. You remember Lyndon Johnson, the War on Poverty? Well, that's why when I wrote Troubled Waters about that period of my life, and I said that I was a foot soldier in Lyndon Johnson's War on Poverty. So I went to law school, I really did, with the idea that I was going to be an OEO poverty lawyer. Here they had California Rural Legal Assistance, which interested me a lot, although I was in the East, so I stayed there. I worked in the South Bronx for 2 years. Amazing. There were buildings there then. Right around the corner was Charlotte Street, where Jimmy Carter later stood and said he would save the South Bronx. There are now, in the middle of these giant, high-rise, cubongous buildings of the South Bronx, like about 10 ranch houses on Charlotte Street. It's the most bizarre sight you've ever seen. They're so completely out of place. That was Jimmy Carter saving the South Bronx. So that was my plan. But I burned out after 2 years, which everybody, of course, told me would happen. And then I fled into criminal law. I went to criminal appeals and I read transcripts and, you know, did appeals. Had 5 cases in front of the Court of Appeals in Albany, which was interesting. But after 3 years of that, it was like so bloodless. I kept reading these transcripts and thinking, hey, I could do a better summation than this guy did. So had to put my money where my mouth was and went to Brooklyn.
The books that you've written have a lot of those books come out of your time as an attorney?
Yes.
Did you make notes back then?
Oh, yes.
And say someday this is going to be in a book?
Well, I am not saying I've used all the incidents. I mean, the incidents from my true life probably took me through 2 books. And from that time, it's been more, because I have not stuck with only criminal law. In this particular book, we also have an acrimonious divorce situation, and so there are some bits of law that come in from that, and fresh kills, caskets involved in an adoption situation. So I'm trying to deal with areas of law besides just straight criminal law, which involves research, because I really haven't done these things.
Do you love doing research?
I do, actually. There are people who love it and people who hate it, and Loving it is good, except that you have to know when to stop. And, of course, I never do know when to stop. See, if I've ever wrote it, I've always had a desire to write an historical mystery, but I don't know. I think that would be a dangerous thing to do. The research could eat my life.
I was talking with you earlier about this, and I had to stop from talking with you because I knew we'd be coming in here, but you get such wonderful reviews, and I'm curious how... Do you think they influence sales a lot, a little? Do you think it's word of mouth? What do you
think? I really have no idea. I really don't. I do know that reviews influence me as a reader, which I am certainly a lifelong reader, into if there's somebody, when there's somebody I haven't heard of and they get great reviews. I mean, Michael Connelly comes to mind. He's somebody actually whose first couple of books I hadn't read because I have so many old favorites to read. But when I saw the kinds of reviews he was getting, I thought, I got to find out what this guy's doing. And I think he's terrific.
Will Cass come to California?
She may go to Oklahoma. But I'm not sure about California. I am working on a book that involves California, but it's what we call in the trade a one-off, meaning one out of the series. And it involves a mother and a daughter, both lawyers. So I'm looking for the legal thriller thing, only the legal thriller with a heart. I mean, that the characters are important. Their relationship is what's really vital. The daughter needs to learn some compassion in her life, especially if she's going to become a judge. She wants to be a judge, but the problem is she doesn't have a heart at the beginning of the book. But when I'm finished with her.
So is this the next book in the series?
Well, no, it's not in the series. It's out of the series. But it's the next thing I'm working on. But I think I want Cass to take a death penalty case, which, of course, she could do in New York now, which she couldn't have done when I started this series, thank God. But they have now instituted the death penalty. And, yeah, I like the idea of her going to Oklahoma and being in a completely different, as we said, my cousin Vinny. I think she would feel like, you know, suddenly she would feel very self-conscious about her New Yorkiness in this setting, and that would be interesting for her to have to deal with being a stranger, you know, in this place. So,
you're also a writing coach. You teach, you do seminars, you're a public speaker. Do you have any last words for any words of wisdom for our listeners now that we're coming to the end of our show?
Novels are big. This is my big insight into writing novels. They are big. And what this means is, first of all, it will take a humongous amount of time. Whatever time you're planning on spending writing your novel, double it, maybe triple it. Second thing, whether you do it by outline or you do it by plunging right in, you will commit three times as much unusable prose as you will usable prose. Be prepared to write a lot of garbage. So if you're looking at your stuff now and you say, I've got 100 pages here, and I don't know where it's going, and I don't know what's useful and what isn't, I'm suggesting to you that if 30 pages of that 100 pages turn out to be usable, you're doing pretty well. Don't be discouraged.
Interesting. Do you think short stories are a necessary prerequisite to writing novels?
No, not necessary. Fun and a very nice break. But I certainly didn't do short stories before, except when I was a kid, but not published ones as an adult.
I sure thank you for being here.
Well, thank you. This has been fun. You're right. The time flew.
The time flew. My goodness. Let's see. What's coming up? Okay, I'm going to talk about this again. On Saturday and Sunday, September 5th and 6th, the second annual Books by the Beach will take place in Laguna Beach at the Festival of the Arts grounds. Authors will include T. Jefferson Parker, Martin J. Smith, Allison Johnson, Maxine O'Callaghan, Barbara Serinella, and more. I'll be moderating a few panels. The cost is $6 for both days. Call 497-7053 for more information. Benefits the libraries of Orange County. Call 566-3060 as well. Join us next week when T. Jefferson Parker, author of Where Serpents Lie, and poet Victor Infante will be my guests. We may also have someone here from the libraries to talk about the book fair. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett at KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. If you need to reach me, fax me at 760-1443. Music programming will follow my show with on-air, off-air. Thanks for listening and get to work. And remember, it's all about writing like there's no tomorrow.